Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Avert fiscal cliff crisis? Check. Swear a new Congress? Check. Cut government spending and raise the debt ceiling? Oh boy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, January 4th. Thanks for joining us. It's the first Friday of the month when we find out just how much of a job creator the U.S. has been lately. The word from the Labor Department, 155,000 new jobs in December, but not enough to push the unemployment rate down any lower. We're still at 7.8%. Joining us now to talk jobs, the economy, and what I'm calling fiscal cliffness are Lee Gallagher of Fortune and Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Hey, Sarah.
Lee, let's start with you. 7.8% unemployment. Are we stuck?
You know, the longer-term trend here is that we're slowly going down. I think, the economy is recovering. There's some bigger forces that are at work here, both employers being a lot more productive in the past 4 years as they've had to get more productive with fewer resources.
Right.
And then, you know, we're still in the middle of this sort of 30-year shift from an industrial economy to a service economy. So there are kind of seismic shifts that are happening on top of everything else. So I don't think that this is terrible. I think this is okay. And if you drill down, you know, construction jobs were up a little bit. The housing market's recovering. So there's some bright spots to be seen in this number.
Cardiff, did you see any hopeful signs in the report?
I guess the most hopeful sign was just that it was resilient at the end of the year, even as there were all these widespread worries about whether or not the fiscal cliff drama was going to affect the economy.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing here is that the last few months of the payrolls reports have been unbelievably consistent. They've been right at about 150,000 jobs. And actually, if you average it out over the last 2 years, it's almost at the exact same point. And so despite all the swings and all the threats we've had to the economy in the last couple of years, you've seen it steadily improve. Unfortunately, it hasn't been that impressive an improvement given the scale of the unemployment problem. But I think there are some signs that the economy is poised for a little bit better growth this year. Of course, we need policymakers to play along, and that's definitely not a given.
Right, right. Which brings us to our next topic. We have the fiscal cliff deal finally. Lee, when does the next crisis begin?
Well, it begins immediately. I mean, it begins as soon as the 113th Congress was sworn in. I mean, this gridlock is going to be with us and very soon, i.e. like Monday, people are going to start thinking about 2014 and then 2016. So the
politicization.
There you go.
Thank you. Is only going to, you know, increase. And I'm afraid we're in for more tussle. You know, the debt ceiling negotiation is the
right
next step.
Right.
Obviously.
What do you think, Cardiff? Are we facing sort of what I'm beginning to call this permanent state of cliffness where we just go from one crisis to the next because Congress can't, you know, make any big deals because it's so divided?
Yeah, it's possible. And you keep seeing some of these problems postponed. I don't know that they're all going to rise to the level of crisis.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them are just going to be kind of ongoing contentious debates. The exception, though, is the one that's about to take place, which is over the debt ceiling. And we saw how unbelievably contentious that was in 2011. And there's a pretty good chance that it's going to be just as tough a fight this time round. But my guess is that it'll go down to the last minute. There'll be some kind of negotiation then, and we'll move on. But in terms of like the fractiousness of the American Congress, yeah, that's not going anywhere for at least a couple of years.
Here's my question, and I'll let you both answer it. Do either of you have a New Year's resolution that you think the new Congress should make? And we'll start with you, Lee.
I mean, you know, it may sound basic, but it's like, can't we just get along and think of the greater good for the country rather than thinking about reelection or, you know, ideology?
Yeah.
I'd say stop getting in the way of the recovery because the private sector is in better shape than it has been in a couple of years. And yet we keep having these fights over, you know, a grand bargain or the deficit. But actually, we don't have an immediate deficit problem. We have a medium to long term deficit problem. But we can deal with that later. And you know what? Focusing on the recovery now will help with that longer term problem then. So just get out of the way.
Yeah. Finally, one more thing, just going back to that 7.8% unemployment rate. Do you think it can get any better until we resolve, I mean, until we get this debt ceiling resolved? We're probably not going to see that improve, right?
Oh, I think it might. I wouldn't be surprised if it does. I mean, you know, we're in a recovery right now, and it might be a little bit muted. We'll never know what kind of recovery we'd be in right now if we hadn't spent the past 2 months distracted by the fiscal cliff and companies hadn't pared back their budgets.
Right.
But we are in one, and I think it'll continue to get better. And, you know, month to month, it can improve a percentage point or two. It can totally happen, I think.
Cardiff, do you agree?
I agree entirely. And I'd also say that it's important not to emphasize too much the exact number of the unemployment rate and more look at the underlying trend. So whether or not jobs are actually growing, because the way that the unemployment rate is calculated is a little bit complex and it can sort of fluctuate for various reasons. So look at how many jobs are being created month to month rather than the actual number. And yes, I think things will get better.
Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville and Lee Gallagher of Fortune. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Guess which key stock index hit a five-year high today? The answer when we do the numbers. As Lee and Cardiff just mentioned, the fiscal cliff deal leaves Congress with a lot of unfinished business. It also leaves us with an ongoing debate about just who is rich or wealthy. Is it families making at least $250,000, $450,000? And what do they think about being labeled as rich? Marketplace's wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark found out.
Talking about wealth is taboo in this country. So when I ask Scott Leonard, the CEO of a wealth management company based in Southern California, how much he makes, it gets uncomfortable for both of us.
I'd rather...
Would you rather not share?
Could you give a ballpark?
Yeah, we're certainly under the current fiscal cliff tax rules considered wealthy.
Meaning this year, he and his wife, who's a full-time mom, made at least $450,000, more than 99% of the rest of the country. They recently sold their house near the beach to spend a few years with their three kids sailing around the world on a boat.
It's actually very nice. It's a 50-foot catamaran.
You're living the dream.
Living the dream and not wealthy.
You heard that right.
I still think of myself as middle class, upper middle class. I certainly do not consider myself as rich or wealthy.
Now, if you're starting to roll your eyes, don't worry. He's waiting for it. But he says he's worried because he feels like he hasn't saved enough for retirement or for his kids' college. And besides, in the world that he lives in...
You look around, there's always somebody who's got a better seat than you do at the basketball game. There's always somebody doing something that you can't do. In that sense, you don't necessarily consider yourself wealthy.
That person is wealthy.
This woman, Elizabeth, lives with her husband outside of Los Angeles. They make around $250,000 a year. Elizabeth didn't want to use her last name because she was afraid she'd get in trouble with the parents at the private school where she teaches. Compared to those families who pull up in Bentleys and Mercedes, she doesn't think of herself as rich.
I'm sure for some of the students, I am probably not, you know, the paragon of wealth. But when I look at the rest of the country, I'm very, very fortunate.
But is she wealthy? She says absolutely.
The worries that I do have that are related to money are things about, am I saving enough for retirement? Or what kind of college education will I be able to help my child afford? Which I think are relatively luxurious things to be worrying about.
And the idea that wealth ultimately means being free from worries might be the one thing Elizabeth and Scott Leonard agree on. In fact, Leonard named his yacht Three Little Birds after that Bob Marley song, Don't Worry About a Thing. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
One controversial subject Congress didn't expect to have on its agenda this session was guns. That changed after the mass murder in Newtown. One starting point for any debate over restricting guns is the huge number of them already in American homes, about 300 million. David Gura reports on one reason the number of guns is going up, even as the number of people who own them is going down.
At one level, companies that make guns are like the companies that make other durable goods. Garen Wintemute heads the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis.
They have a responsibility to their shareholders and to their owners to maximize profit, and they can't do that unless they maximize sales.
Wyndham Ute has studied the firearms industry for most of his career, and he says gun companies have to deal with something that car makers or appliance companies don't have to deal with.
The challenge that the durability of firearms poses to the manufacturer is it makes it harder for them to maintain their sales.
They need to get customers to buy firearms. Robert Spitzer is a political science professor at SUNY Cortland, and he says most firearms have a long shelf life.
You can buy a gun, put it in your dresser drawer or stick it in a closet, and it can sit there for decades and be perfectly functional when you pull it out many, many years later.
And that, it seems, is what a lot of gun owners do. Larry Hyatt owns the Hyatt Gun Shop in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's one of the largest gun specialty stores in the U.S.
They buy multiple guns. They may have 15 or 20 guns. They may only shoot one or two of them. The rest of them, they just got put away.
It's very important to the gun industry to cultivate collectors, enthusiasts who will buy multiple firearms.
The fact that people buy more than one gun is what keeps this business going.
Hyatt says different customers like different things. Some want ornate rifles, others want cowboy guns.
People that are coming out of the military service today, they like the assault-type guns because that's what they were trained with in the service. That's what they like.
Hyatt says a lot of factors drive gun sales: history, movies, TV, and manufacturers target consumers.
25 years ago, if you had told me that they would have pink guns on the market and people would buy them, I would have lost that bet.
Hyatt says manufacturers do a good job coming up with new products, with new features, in new colors. And that's one reason UC Davis's Garen Wintemute says there are so many guns in the U.S.
We have less than 5% of the world's population, but we control more than 40% of the firearms that are in civilian hands.
It's impossible to know exactly how many guns there are. We don't have a federal registry. Peter Cook, a public policy professor at Duke, says researchers rely on surveys, some information from manufacturers, and some from the FBI.
In just 6 years, we've seen a doubling of the total number of background checks.
In 2012, federally licensed dealers conducted 19 million background checks. Keep in mind, there's no direct link between the number of background checks and the number of guns sold. Some checks result in denial. Some people buy several guns. But Robert Spitzer of SUNY Cortland says this is what's surprising.
The percentage of Americans who own guns, one or more guns, has been declining for about the last 50 years or so.
And today, the number of households with guns is 1 in 3, down from 1 in 2 in the 1960s. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, headhunters in search of freelancers.
They basically just call us up or they find us online, and we do anything from illustrations to concept design. Whatever they want, we do.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 43 points, a third of 1%, to wrap at 13,435. The NASDAQ inched up 1 point, a fraction of a percent, to end at 3101. The S&P 500 ticked up 7 points, half a percent, to finish at 1466. That's a five-year high for the S&P. For the week, the Dow gained nearly 4%, the S&P 500 added 4.5%, and the NASDAQ charged up almost 5%. Apple peeled off 2.8% on concern that iPhones are losing the smartphone war. Google added nearly 2%. Microsoft deleted 1.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 1.90%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Orthodox Christians in Russia and other parts of the world celebrate Christmas. In New York City, it's your last chance to see the Rockefeller Christmas tree in all its glory. The tree is scheduled to be unplugged Monday night. And on January 7th, 1963, the cost of a first-class stamp went up from 4 to 5 cents. Literally, a penny for your thoughts. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. As we noted earlier, the debate over the debt ceiling is coming up soon. Raising the limit for government borrowing used to be a mere formality, but it became a battleground starting in 2001. After the fiscal cliff debate, folks weary of congressional brinksmanship are looking for a magic bullet to make this whole recurring debt crisis go away. And they think they've found it in a platinum coin worth $1 trillion. Okay, Mark Garrison, explain this one for us.
So here's the idea, which even supporters admit sounds pretty goofy. Using power from an obscure law, the Treasury mints a platinum coin, face value $1 trillion. That coin is deposited at the Fed, and just like that, plenty of money to pay the bills, and the debt ceiling doesn't matter.
We all recognize why it's absurd.
Joe Wiesenthal is Business Insider's deputy editor and one of the coin's most vocal cheerleaders. No matter how ridiculous a trillion-dollar coin may sound, they say it's not any crazier than the debt ceiling debate.
Given the helplessness that perhaps people feel about the politics of it, I'm actually not surprised that people are excited about this idea.
It's not just finance wonks having an online romp. Democratic Congressman Jerry Nadler said this week it's an idea worth considering. So what about inflation? Investment advisor Cullen Roach, one of the coin's earliest supporters, says inflation won't be a factor because the precious coin won't circulate.
It doesn't increase the outstanding money supply. It literally is just an accounting change.
Chris Krueger sees plenty of pitfalls to the trillion-dollar coin trick, from currency market reaction to a likely legal battle. For the senior policy analyst at Guggenheim Securities, the concept is no longer academic.
The odds of this happening are not zero, but the odds should be zero. The idea that this is even possible speaks volumes to how serious this crisis could become.
Seething anger at broken politics, part of why a nutty idea about a magic coin is gaining currency. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Farmers, grocery stores, and food companies have waited 2 years plus for the FDA to propose new rules for food safety. They finally came out today, and Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us what would change.
Food safety today goes like this.
People get sick, food gets recalled, oops, we got a problem.
According to Sandra Eskin at the Pew Health Group, the rules proposed today will force food producers to have a safety plan beforehand that FDA has to approve.
I'm XYZ Peanut Butter Corporation. I got to walk around my facility, my operation is, are we roasting the nuts to an adequate temperature? Am I making sure I'm keeping them separate, roasted nuts from the raw nuts?
These new rules could have prevented a peanut butter crisis last fall when salmonella turned up in product at Trader Joe's. The changes also apply to farmers, all but the smallest ones. A cantaloupe contamination killed 33 people 2 years ago. The food industry backed the bill that created today's rules, but its whole way of doing business is going to change, says attorney Will Woodley at Kleinfeld, Kaplan & Becker.
Everything you do has to be documented so that when FDA comes to inspect, they can see what you've done and how you've got there. And if you haven't documented it, it didn't happen in FDA's eyes.
It'll be 2 years plus before the new prevention system starts. By then, Celia Wexler at the Union of Concerned Scientists will be at ease. Kind of.
I would have a bit more confidence as I went through the food and produce section. I might indeed start buying peanut butter again.
But not now? You don't buy it now?
No, I do not.
Wexler also worries if the FDA will have enough money to hire enough inspectors. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Ever doubt the resilience of the human spirit? Check out a new book by a woman named Ping Fu. She's the founder and CEO of a 3D software company called Geomagic. She's been honored by the White House. She's been an Entrepreneur of the Year. And the American government has named her an outstanding American. All this after surviving a harrowing childhood in China during the Cultural Revolution, after her parents were sent away to a re-education camp. Her new memoir is called Bend Not Break, A Life in Two Worlds. Ping Fu, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you said the Red Guard used to force you to recite the words, "I'm a bug, my life is worthless." Did you believe it at the time?
After I repeated many times that I was nobody, I started to believe it.
You essentially had no formal education from the time you were 8 years old until the time you were about 18. Were you learning anything during that time?
I did learn a lot of things when I was working in the factories. So I think of myself as a maker because I learned how to build radios, TV sets, speedometer for cars.
And you faced a lot of adversity during that time. I mean, you were gang raped when you were 10 by some teenage boys in the Red Guard. Your sister almost drowned. You saved her. How did you survive all that?
I think it was my little sister. I felt enormous responsibility to take care of her. Without her, I don't know what I would do. I probably would be killed or be much careless about protecting my own life. But with the little girl next to me, I had to survive.
Now, eventually, after the Cultural Revolution, the universities opened up again, and you said you had a voracious appetite for learning. What did you do?
I was like a sponge, and I wanted to be an astronaut, but I was assigned to study Chinese literature. And that turns out to be just such a blessing. I couldn't believe that reading literature, watching movie, talking about play, you call that study. And I want to learn everything and anything that's in front of me.
And then you came to this country, and you knew three words. What were they?
Help. Thank you. Hello.
Help, thank you, and hello. It's amazing. You did get your degree in computer science in this country, and you became a leader at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and you are now the CEO of a 3D computer software company whose clients include NASA. Now, that's like the amazing immigrant story.
I lived such an amazing life in two drastically different worlds. And I never imagined I would arrive at where I am. And being a little girl wanted to be an astronaut and couldn't even study that field, and to end up to provide technology that helped secure the safety return of astronaut, I feel like life came to the full circle. And I am living in the American dream.
When you look back on the hardships of your childhood, how do you think they allowed you to get where you are today?
When I grew up, I learned a lot about self-learning, and I learned a lot about adapting to changes. And I have to have a lot of resilience.
Right.
And all of those things like self-learning, adapt to changes, and the enduring power of resilience are the quality of successful entrepreneurs.
What is your best advice for young people in this country who want to become entrepreneurs?
First of all, you have to understand who you are authentically and then understand why you want to do what you do. Some people think they start a company because they didn't like to work for anyone. That's the wrong reason.
Huh.
Or if you just wanted to make money, that's not the reason either.
So making money isn't a good reason to become an entrepreneur?
I don't think so. I think you don't make money just because you want to make money. You make money because you create value.
Ping Fu is founder and CEO of GeoMagic. Her new book is Bend, Not Break. Ping Fu, thanks so much for talking with us.
Good to be here.
As we told you, the U.S. economy created 155,000 jobs in December. Now, that's a solid gain, but probably not much solace to all the folks looking for full-time work. In this economy, a lot of companies are saving money by hiring freelancers, people who can come in, finish a project, and then leave without costing the company health insurance or other benefits. Audrey Quinn looks at the online business of freelance headhunting.
This story is about recruiters and freelancers. As it turns out, I met recruiter industry vet Chris Bensky in a place filled with freelancers, a Manhattan cafe.
Just live over here.
He gives me a quick history lesson. Bensky says that way back when, it was the job seekers, not the companies, that hired recruiters.
Yeah, the recruiters would work for a fee for the person looking for a job. It was a way to break into the middle class, because once you had the job, you had it for 30 to 40 years.
Around the 1980s, people started changing jobs more, and companies, instead of workers, became the ones that hired recruiters. recruiters would set out on a headhunt to find the perfect person for a position. But the rise of freelancers is throwing another twist in that model. Companies can't afford to spend months looking for short-term workers.
The recruitment industry will survive this. It's not something that's going to be the end of recruitment, but the recruitment industry has to move at an accelerated pace.
One way the industry is doing this is by building online recruiting platforms. Freelancers sign up, list their skills, businesses post their needs, and people on both sides can find each other. Elaine de la Mata uses those kinds of platforms to find work. I meet her at her home office overlooking a Brooklyn freeway. The back wall is covered with stuffed animals, action figures, and craft kits.
How many different toys do you think you have on these shelves?
Oh my God. We actually just got rid of a lot. So, I don't know. 1,000?
De la Mata and her husband Kurt Marquardt are freelance toy designers. They take on design projects for big toy companies.
They basically just call us up or they find us online, and we do anything from illustrations to concept design to packaging, graphics, logos, whatever they want, we do.
De la Mata and Marquardt have profiles on a couple different online platforms. She shows me the profile on the site Coraflow.
So this is what it looks like. We have all sorts of different portfolios that people can scroll through.
She clicks through pictures of their past work. They've done Dora the Explorer graphics, Barbie doll packaging, and Build-A-Bear sketches.
And I'm able to break it down into the different types of services that we offer. Basically, just any kind of quick information that somebody needs to find if they're looking for a toy designer.
De La Mata has been really happy with the sites. They still only provide a fraction of her work, about a job a month, but they help keep things steady and get her name out. And the next service she'd like to see for freelancers? Somebody to track down clients that haven't paid. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, we've been asking our listeners this week to fill in the blank. You know you're wealthy when... Take a listen.
You know you're wealthy when your kids' college is paid for and they're only three.
You're wealthy when you don't think about the price of what you're buying, ever.
You are not living paycheck to paycheck.
When you fly several flights a month and you don't know the acronym TSA.
You know you're wealthy when you have almost as many items plugged into your Wi-Fi network as you do your outlets.
It would be great if I could be wealthy, but I just aim to be comfortable.
More of those in a photo slideshow at marketplace.org. You'll get it when you see it. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what the hit to a post-fiscal cliff paycheck really means.
I'm probably going to be missing at least $80 a month, which is, that's baby food and a lot of diapers right there. I'm going to have to come up with somewhere else.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.